The world is experiencing a refugee crisis of unprecedented proportions right now. And today, on World Refugee Day, I'll talk with an Iowa couple who recently returned from Jordan, where they work to help Syrian refugees. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Ethan and Bethany Anderson were only able to spend a week in Jordan working with refugee families, but they came home with a powerful message to share. I'll talk with them. Later in the hour, she's played with Celine Dion, Lady Gaga, Paul McCartney, and Kiss. Now violinist and former Miss Iowa Lisa Donlinger is going solo. I'll talk with her about her new album, Movies and the Masters. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Hollywood violinist and former Miss Iowa, Lisa Donlinger, about her new solo album, Movies and the Masters. But first, today is World Refugee Day. It's a day set aside to honor the courage and endurance of those who've been forced to flee from their homes. And this World Refugee Day falls at a time when there are more displaced persons on Earth than ever before. One of the places where the pain is the greatest is Syria. 4.9 million Syrians are refugees. And like so many others, Ethan and Bethany Anderson of West Liberty have watched developments in Syria. They wanted to do something beyond making donations. They felt helpless to make a difference, but then they decided that they themselves would travel to Jordan to work with Syrian refugees. And I spoke with them back in February before their trip. Now they're back to share what they saw, did, and learned while they were in Jordan. Ethan and Bethany, welcome back to the show.
Hello. Thanks.
Well, thank you both so much for being here today. And remind me again, we spoke about this back in February, but as a couple living in Iowa with three young kids and a lot going on in life, what made you decide that you needed to go to Jordan?
I think that we had just been following along with everybody with the news of the Syrian refugee crisis, and it was just breaking our hearts. It was so sad to see this trauma that was happening, and we kind of, you know, were just thinking, what in the world can we do? You know, how can we help? And feeling kind of like we needed to find a way, a practical way, a hands-on way to help. And we both really love traveling, and so we decided, let's just find a place that's already working with Syrian refugees and helping them. And so we did a little bit of research and found this wonderful church in Mafraq, Jordan, that was doing just that.
Now, as you were preparing for your trip, you started fundraising, you started communicating with friends, family, and others about why you were going and what you were going to be doing there. What kind of an outpouring did you get from people before the trip?
I was really surprised about that. It just kind of happened organically. As soon as people found out that we were going, you know, I think the first few people who donated money did it completely unprompted, just saying, we've been looking for a way to, you know, help too, and you know, can you take this and give it to the church there that's doing the work? So Bethany actually, kind of when that started, she said we should set a goal. You know, let's say $10,000. And I looked at her. I said, I think that's going to look pretty ridiculous when we get 1,000. You know, so I so that's kind of crazy, and we decided to go for it. So we raised over almost $10,600,
wow,
as well as four suitcases full of toys and toiletries, clothes and goods and things we can bring as well. So there really was an outpouring.
So in connecting with this church, what kind of expectations did you have before you left about what you would be doing when you were there?
Yeah, the church has been very open to taking volunteers, and so they're very organized, and they kind of gave us sort of an expectation of the work that they're doing and home visits and the school that they have and that kind of thing. So they just let us know that, yeah, we would be welcome to come and kind of follow along with them. And just that was basically what we did, kind of shadow them in all the different facets of their outreach work.
Now, give me an idea. You know, we're talking about Syrian refugees, but you went to Jordan. Give me an idea of what this Syrian population is like in Jordan, because this refugee crisis has been going on a long time.
That's right. So Jordan, being one of the neighboring countries with Syria, has accepted about 650,000 refugees. And this town is just a few miles from the Syrian border. So the town really just kind of, it basically doubled in size and accepted in almost 80,000 refugees who are just trying to resettle in the town. In addition, there's the largest Syrian refugee camp is close to that town as well. And that has about another 80,000 refugees in it as well. So just being so close to the border, it's just kind of a natural place for people crossing over to try to settle in.
And you were going to work not at the refugee camp, not with the United Nations, but with refugees, people who were trying to make it on their own, right?
Correct. Right. That's right. So they're in the town trying to make it on their own. And there's definitely some support, you know, through various networks and organizations, the church being one of those. But they are, right, they're just trying to find housing, see if there's a way for them to work, you know, get their kids in school, et cetera. So when you think about like you said, many of them have been there now for years. So they're really, you know, the work is somehow shifting from immediate relief, like shelter and food, although there is still some of that going on, but a lot of kind of more development, long-term things are developing too.
Were you able to talk with the refugees about their experiences, about what they were able to bring with them and how they were able to get to Jordan safely? Is there a story that you could share?
We got a few little glimpses when we did go on home visits. The church staff and volunteers kind of didn't bring that up just because of the sensitive, you know, nature, and people might not really want to talk about that kind of thing. So if people brought it up on their own, you know, we got a few little glimpses, but not a whole lot, because, you know, people were just trying to be sensitive to their privacy. And, you know, we did, I think, catch a few little glimpses.
Yeah, what did you learn from those glimpses?
One story that was relayed to us was how the families feared for their safety while they were fleeing. So we were talking with one family. They were saying, we didn't want the Syrian army to know that we were actually fleeing the country. And so we got on the bus without anything. I mean, literally no bags, no nothing that would indicate that they were going on a trip any longer than a day trip. So, you know, traveling in that way, just literally starting their lives over without
leaving everything behind.
Yes. I mean, not a change of socks. I mean, just everything. So
what was a day like for you? You said you were kind of shadowing the efforts of the church. What did you do throughout the day?
So we did go on a lot of home visits, which was one of my favorite parts of what we did there. And in the home visit, each church staff member or volunteer has their kind of rotating list of people that they check up on. And so they would just schedule those visits and call ahead and see if it was okay if we stopped by. And we would go to the refugee's home, usually a very basic, you know, small cement home. We would always be welcome.
An apartment or?
Sometimes an apartment, yes. Oftentimes an apartment, or sometimes just a small, like, cement block home. And we would always be welcomed very warmly, go in, sit down on the floor on their mats, which double both as beds and couches, kind of in their living room there, and sit down with them. They would bring us tea or coffee, just very hospitable. And then the volunteer, the staff member, would just visit with them, talk to them, see how things were going, if they had any needs, that kind of thing. So that was the home visits. We did several of those, probably about, I don't know, eight or so while we were there.
At least.
What were the needs that came up? Obviously they need to have enough food to eat. And were they getting assistance in looking for work? I know employment is really difficult because, of course, Jordan had this huge influx of people and everybody wants a job. What's mm-hmm. the employment situation like?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say we're experts on how that part of it works, but Jordan is, we understand, giving some work permits to some of them. A lot of them are, I think, working under the table. The church is kind of, their role there is providing some vocational training. So they have like some sewing classes, they have English classes, and they're just, I think, helping these families navigate really whatever they need. We definitely saw healthcare questions and concerns come up, things with the kids, you know, in school. So it's really just kind of it's a well check. You know, they come and just really want to see, check in on their well-being and kind of all aspects. So the church is visiting, they told us, between 400 and 500 families per month, and then they kind of, that sort of rotates, you know, there are so many to talk to, but yeah, that's what they're...
Now, I know some of these refugee families have been there for maybe 7 years, you know, or 3 years. Are there new families coming in all the time?
At this point, Jordan is not accepting any more refugees. They had to close the border about a year back, and so there are no new refugee families coming in at this time. So probably everybody who's been there has been there for at least a year.
There is some movement, though, and some people who are leaving the camp, you know, and settling on their own. They can do that under certain circumstances.
So moving from the camp into this community that you
right.
were visiting.
Exactly. It's very interesting to see the camp because they're not free to go, and I don't know exactly the rules there, but I can tell you we drove past the camp that, you know, someone from the church took us out to kind of see it just from the outside. And, you know, if you can imagine a city of 80,000 people, and we drove by sort of the main gate at maybe, I think it was 6 o'clock, like on a weekday evening, zero traffic in and out. And so it's not maybe as cozy as you might think. They're really not really free to go. So if they have the ability to get work or make arrangements, and they'll try to make it on their own. So that's one of the things that we were seeing.
Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Ethan and Bethany Anderson. They live in West Liberty, Iowa, and decided that they wanted to be involved in helping Syrian refugees. So this spring, they traveled to Jordan for a week to work with a church relief organization in Jordan. We're finding out more about what they experienced, what they saw, and what they want all of us to know about what's going on in Syria and in Jordan right now. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, a conversation with violinist and former Miss Iowa Lisa Donlinger. She's just released a solo album called Movies and the Masters, and she's back in the state to perform at and act as a judge at the Miss Iowa pageant this week. But right now, we're talking about refugees from Syria living in Jordan. Ethan and Bethany Anderson of West Liberty went to Jordan this spring to help out in this refugee community. And we talked to them before they left. Now we're talking to them about what they experienced when they were there. Now, we've talked quite a bit about these home visits that you did. And I'd love to know what your takeaway was after visiting these families, seeing how these Syrian families are living. Obviously, they're getting a little bit of assistance. But what should we all know about how these families are living today?
Yeah, I think one of the coolest things for me was just meeting these people face to face. And, you know, they've kind of settled into a sort of normalcy at this point, but it's still really, really difficult for them. I mean, just like it would be for any one of us if we had to pick up with nothing and just plop ourselves in a different country and start all over again. So it's a long road. You know, it's not just, you know, having shelter and having food. It's a long road to resettling, and that not knowing if they'll ever be able to go back home again, you know, is very, I think, difficult for people, because most of them would love to be able to go back home, but, you know, they just don't know if that's ever going to be an option for them.
I think the thing for me is, and every time, you know, every time we travel, I think we see this, but it's just that people are people. I mean, we're so much more alike than we are different. And I think we've just seen that everywhere, and here's no exception. I mean, these families have the same concerns that we have, by and large, through a little bit different cultural lens and everything, but they're, you know, they just want to provide for their families. They want safety and education for their kids. They want to have fulfilling lives, and at the same time, they struggle with the same things we struggle with. You know, they struggle with finances. They struggle with, you know, their marriage, or they struggle with training their kids. I mean, all these things are just, they're so normal, you know, and that's just, I think it's so easy for us to see people so far away in a different culture, in a different religion, as somehow so very different from the way we are. And it's just not true. They're very much like us.
Now, last time you were here, you were carrying around your Arabic flashcards.
Right.
How did that go for you?
Pretty rusty. I was pretty rusty. It was 14 years ago when I studied Arabic, and my Arabic teacher actually wrote on my Facebook, "How is your Arabic in Mafraqan?" So, it did come back a bit. You know, it was better at the end of the week than it was at the beginning.
Did that give you an opportunity? I mean, obviously, it was, as you said, rusty. Did it give you an opportunity to talk directly with people?
Oh, certainly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, depending upon the topic, I can have a conversation. And, you know, it really just kind of any type of connection that we had with these families was, I think, valuable. And I think, you know, most of the things that we talked about were, you know, showing, we'd like to show pictures of our kids, like on our phone to them, you know, so that they could see that little glimpse into our life. And Bethany learned how to describe our family in Arabic to them, so we could kind of have that conversation. And, you know, and I think conversely, it also helped them feel encouraged and maybe change their perception too of Americans in some way, or Christians. And so I think, yeah, that was fun, you know, in both directions to see that happening.
You also visited schools when you were there, and I'm sure that again, not just an influx of people, but all of the services that people need, Jordan had to scale up and make these services available. So what are the schools like?
Yeah, so in response to this influx of refugees, Jordan set up a system where Jordanian kids will go to school in the morning, and then the Syrian refugee kids go to school in the afternoon. Oh, wow. So they have a split day like that. And so what the church did was they decided to start their own school to kind of give kids that extra boost. Many of these kids had been out of school for years and were really, really far behind academically. Mm-hmm. And so they started this elementary school, which now has 8 grades, 180 kids,
160, I think.
160 kids. And just a really beautiful facility. So the kids go to the church school in the morning, and then they'll go to the Jordanian public school in the afternoon. So they kind of get a little boost academically, and it's just fun to see them just really enjoying school and getting caught up academically.
Now, of course, public education is something that it's easy for us to take for granted here. Are all the children getting to go to school? Do they all have access to these services?
I think so. In our understanding, that the Jordanian government made that available to all of the Syrian refugee families. I think not all of them really are taking advantage of it. And like Bethany said, the church told us that they tested kids when they were starting their school, and they started just with a few grades and then have kind of been scaling it up. And they were, they told us, like, kids from age 6 to age 10, like, couldn't read or write, you know. So there's definitely a problems there, you know, with the way that's happening. But Jordan has really stepped up and provided what they can, at least some semblance of school for them.
Now, I can imagine that if I were a Jordanian parent and my kids suddenly went from having, you know, normal school education to going to school in the mornings while other students went in the afternoon, that would be difficult to deal with. Are there conflicts between Jordanians and the Syrian refugees?
I think we heard both sides from the Jordanians that we talked to. Obviously, all of the Jordanian volunteers and staff at the church are just loving the opportunity to help and reach out. And we talked to a lot of taxi drivers and just asked them, you know, what they think about it. And some said, yeah, it's good that we're helping. I'm glad that we're helping. And some kind of had a negative view of, you know, it's a mixed bag, just like here or anywhere else.
It's like here or anywhere, yeah, right.
You also visited the soccer program. Tell me about that.
Right. So, again, one of those things that the church does just to get the kids involved, you know, and teach them some skills, leadership and whatnot. So they have a soccer program. Every 6 weeks, they start a new session. So the class that we were, the thing that we were a part of, was they were just setting up the teams. There were 72 kids there, which is more than they really can handle, but they figured out a way to get them all in. And there was one little boy sitting next to us on the sidelines just as they were getting started, and the coach kind of called for all the boys to go and line up in lines. And he didn't get up, this little boy. And I said, you know, don't you want to go and play, you know? And he said, you know, I just want to watch, he said. And that's kind of the thing you say, right, when you're, you know, a child and you're embarrassed about something. And then Bethany nudged me and pointed down he didn't have any shoes. So that was probably the reason why he didn't want to. So, you know, just to see those basic needs that these families are, you know, trying to deal with is That's you know, those are things we can help with. I mean, that's so simple. And he did actually eventually get up and run around barefoot. So, but it's a neat program. Yeah.
I'm talking to Ethan and Bethany Anderson of West Liberty. They spent a week working with Syrian refugees this spring, and they're talking with us about what they learned during their visit. You were working with a church in Mafraq, Jordan, and I'm curious because, you know, coming from Syria, there are refugees of different religions. There are Muslim refugees. There are Christian refugees. With the church, was religion part of deciding who would get assistance, who would be helped?
That's a good question. And all of the refugee families that we met were Muslim families. And I think, at least there in Mafraq, the vast majority are Muslim. So that was one of the coolest parts, was to see this Christian community reaching out in love to the Muslim community and, you know, going into their homes, just caring for them, caring about them. And I think, like Ethan said, it kind of is opening eyes in both directions, just as far as just seeing Muslims, seeing Christians. You know, as people that, you know, you need to take care of and help out and love even across those barriers.
We were in one home with a mother, and she was telling us a story of when she arrived in Mafraq the first time, and she was looking for some assistance. She was looking for, I think, some NGO that was helping, and she was kind of walking down the main street and looking for where to go. And someone noticed that she was new and didn't know where to go, and she grabbed her and said, "Have you been to the church over here?" And she said, "No, I hadn't even heard about it." And this person said, "Go to the church because they have mercy." And we just saw that as a neat, I mean, she just volunteered that story to us, and we saw that as a neat, I guess just a neat story about the reputation that the church has there. They're really, people are so thankful.
Do you feel like you made a difference being there for a week? I know it's not very long. What do you think?
Well, the pastor told us, he said, we're really thankful whenever volunteers come because it just helps people to see that, you know, Westerners care, and it makes them feel special that somebody came all of this way to, you know, just come and show compassion. And so I think it was really fun. We had some really fun interactions with the refugees, and some girls motioned me aside on when we went to a distribution and called me over, and they wanted to take a picture with me. The one girl said, "Selfie, selfie." So I think it was fun for them to, you know, have somebody from the U.S. visiting and just showing interest and concern.
Yeah, that's one of those things, right? How much can you do in just a few days, right? But I think the things we can do are bring awareness, bring a bit of funding, and bring some encouragement both to the workers from the church there and the people who are helping, and also to those families. So I hope we were able to do that.
Your kids are pretty little. What have you been able to share with them about what you did there?
Well, that was a really neat part. They helped us pack the suitcases full of toys and supplies for the refugees. So they knew that, you know, these kids probably didn't have toys of their own. And we showed them pictures when we got back. And it's just been fun, you know, on their own level of understanding, to explain to them, you know, that there are people in the world who don't have as much as we do. And it's our responsibility to help them out when we can.
You've been talking to a lot of groups. You've been talking to a lot of individuals since you came back. What are you hoping people will take away from your experience and your pictures and your stories?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that is one of the big things that we can do, is bring some awareness. So I think, first of all, it's just kind of what I was saying earlier, is to realize that, you know, people are people, and they're not so different from us. I think there's been, you know, we view this really as a humanitarian issue, not a political issue, but it seems like when we talk about it here, people always want to talk about the politics of it, and that's understandable. But really, I think the way that our experience plays into that is to say that, you know, these families are families who are seeking safety and a future for themselves and their kids. And so, you know, any way that we can help that in any way is valuable. I think this is the humanitarian crisis of our day. And so we should all be involved in some way if we can.
Do you have the ability to keep track of the people that you met there? I mean, I know communication can be really difficult. Are you trying to follow along as people go on their journeys?
Not individually with the people we met, but we'd like to go back. We'd like to go back and you know, do it again, and meet some of those people again, and it'd be fun to see how they've come along.
There are many refugee families living in Iowa. Many of those families need help. They come from many different parts of the world. Why travel across the world to do this instead of finding a way to help here?
I think both are important. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked with World Relief in the Chicago area for a couple of years, and I really loved that. I mean, there are so many opportunities to help refugee families in our own communities, and we should definitely do that. But there are a lot of refugee families who will never have that opportunity to come to the U.S. or, you know, go to another country, and they really need our help, too.
What do you think that the most important thing is that you learned from this experience, something that surprised you? I mean, I know you went with a lot of expectations, you'd done a lot of research, but is there something that you learned that really did take you by surprise?
I think for me, like the interactions with Muslim women kind of opened my eyes in a new way. I think without even realizing it, we can have a lot of stereotypes when we see the veil and we see, you know, the way that they dress, and they just feel so different from us, so different from the way that we live. But I was able to interact with a lot of women while I was there and just talk about family, talk about kids, you know, talk to women when they're in their own closed off room and they can take off their veils and their head coverings and just talk about normal stuff that women would talk about anywhere. And that was really neat for me, because I think it's too easy to make quick stereotypes, mm-hmm. when we just don't understand or we don't know people.
Yeah. Ethan, anything to add?
I think just how easy it is to get involved in some way is the thing. There are so many needs. I mean, so many needs. And like you said, not only over there, but here. And the thing I think that always surprises me so much is just that you can get involved in a small, tiny way. I mean, if you are a coach or just any skill you have, you can use that.
Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us, Charity.
Thanks, Charity.
Ethan and Bethany Anderson of West Liberty, they spent a week in Jordan earlier this year working with Syrian refugees, and they came back to tell us about what they learned. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with violinist Lisa Donlinger. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When violinist Lisa Donlinger was studying music at the University of Iowa and later at the University of Indiana, she played with a number of different symphony orchestras. But post-graduation, she decided to head for Los Angeles to see if she could make it in the music business, and make it she has. She's a Grammy-nominated artist who's performed with high-profile musicians as diverse as Celine Dion, Lady Gaga, Sir Paul McCartney, Beyoncé, Kiss, and many others. She also has a long list of TV credits. She's played on dozens of movie soundtracks, and now she's released her first album. It's called Movies and the Masters, and all the songs on the album are mashups of movie themes and well-known classical pieces. And let's play a little sample here. This is called The Magnificent Hoedown. That's just a little bit of The Magnificent Hoedown from Lisa Donlinger's Movies and the Masters. And she is with me now. She's returned to her home state for a visit. Hello, Lisa.
Hi. It's great to see you.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And we chose The Magnificent Hoedown because it's a little bit of a throwback for you, going way back, or a little bit back in time, to when you were in the Miss Iowa pageant. What was that, 1998?
Yeah, that's the year I won. Mm-hmm.
And you played Hoedown as your talent performance, right?
I did. Yeah, I did. And that was the time when the Beef commercial was using it. So it was a really well-known melody. Sometimes with the violin and the pageants, you want to do something that's accessible to all the audience and high entertainment value. So I figured that would be something everybody knew. And yeah, I was able to do that. It was a fun time. And I was able to wear an outfit that Reba McEntire wore on her tour. She allowed me to borrow it for that performance at Miss America. So it's very special.
Oh, wow. So you are back in Iowa now to release your album, but also in conjunction with the Miss Iowa pageant mm-hmm. that's taking place this week and this weekend. Tell me what you're going to be doing with the pageant.
Yeah, it's going to be my first time back judging, and I'll be performing a few of the nights as well. So when they asked me to do that back in January, I figured this is great timing. It actually gave me a deadline to finish the album. So I thought, okay, this is perfect. I get to go back and be a part of the pageant, which I enjoyed so much. And then I have to finish my album. And it was definitely a big push to the finish. We got it done. So I'm happy to be back here and everything's ready to go.
So back when you decided you wanted to be a part of the Miss Iowa pageant in the first place, I mean, you were a very serious classical musician. What convinced you to take part in a beauty pageant?
Yeah, it took a bit of convincing. The thing that started it was I won the Bill Riley State Fair Talent Show, which was on TV in 1996. So some people, I guess, saw me on TV, and they contacted the Miss Iowa Pageant Board. So they called me and asked if I would be interested. And actually, the first time they called, I said, no, I don't think so, because I was, you know, I was valedictorian. I was very serious about academics, very serious about music. I didn't quite see how the pageant was fitting into that situation. But then they were pretty persistent and said, well, but do you know how much scholarship money you can get from this pageant? And it's the largest scholarship organization in the world for women. So I started researching it a bit more and actually realized that the Miss America pageant is so much different than what you see on TV. When you see it on TV, it kind of looks like all the other pageants where maybe like the swimsuit is the only important thing. But really, that's kind of the smallest part of that program. It's about scholarship, philanthropic endeavors, your talent, doing a lot of public speaking, being up on current events. So it was actually quite a big challenge once you get involved in all of it. So I was very thankful. I was very lucky at the University of Iowa. I had scholarships completely all the way through. My first year at Indiana Masters, I had a few loans, and then I had scholarships. So you can also use it to pay off your loans, which I did. And then I was able to be debt-free going into the professional world, which is pretty rare. So I was really thankful to do that.
When you were growing up in Des Moines and you were very serious about your academics and very serious about your music, what kind of future did you envision for yourself?
I did always think I would be a musician. I happened to be good at math. And I remember a lot of my math teachers saying, you should be an engineer. You know, we need more female engineers. And it sounded great. And actually, my first year at the University of Iowa, I was going to double major as a math major and violin. But then I found out I would be in the practice room for 4 hours and then in a math lab for 4 hours and probably not ever have any kind of life. So I knew that music was going to be it. I was kind of doing it as a backup, but I knew somehow, even though I didn't see anybody really doing what I envisioned myself doing, I just believed that was what I had to do. So,
and what did you envision yourself doing?
You know, the vision changed a lot. Originally, I thought I would be in a full-time symphony teaching at the college level. And actually, when I finished the whole time as Miss Iowa, I auditioned for orchestras and I did win some jobs. And that's when I realized it wasn't what I wanted to do.
What made you realize that?
Well, after the year as Miss Iowa, I was able to do a lot of things. I was able to use a lot of my talents as well. So I sing also. I was able to sing, kind of reminded myself how much I loved to sing, because I sang my whole life, except for like the last 2 years of college. I got, you know, really intense in violin. But I then went to Indiana and started singing again. So I wanted to kind of revamp that. I like playing all styles of music, not just orchestral, sitting in the symphony. I realized that I wanted to talk to more people. I wanted to do more school appearances. I wanted to do more public speaking. So yeah, I just realized I was kind of too young to just play in a symphony and just teach at college. So I gave up the jobs and just moved to LA with no job. Sounds like a good fit, right?
Right. What was that like, that first year in LA?
Really, really difficult. Really difficult. I had been lucky before that I'd met a lot of other supportive musicians who wanted to help each other. LA isn't always like that. There are definitely supportive people there. But in the entertainment industry, I think anytime there are larger money at stakes in any field, it's more competitive. And so people weren't always maybe so happy that I had moved there and not so happy to help me find jobs in the beginning. So the first year was me weeding through a lot of people, finding the really good people that are wonderful and genuine, and maybe leaving other people a bit behind. So
when you got out to LA and you were looking for jobs, I mean, being a musician, you were freelancing. You
right.
were going to be working for many different people in many different circumstances. What was your dream? What were you hoping to have happen?
Well, kind of what I'm doing now. I definitely wanted to work on movie soundtracks. I definitely wanted to work in TV and then working with other artists doing record dates. At that point, I wasn't really thinking of well, maybe a little bit, but not so much develop the idea of being a solo artist. It was more, I just want to work in the studios. I want to do all that fun music. And I was really thankful. You know, I would audition and I would play for people. And then, you know, word of mouth is basically how LA works. So you get on certain lists and they realize you're good at certain things and then you're hired for those kind of jobs. So I started working the thing. I mean, it took a number of years, of course, like a lot of hard work before I got the jobs I really wanted. But, you know, starting working in TV on shows like American Idol and, you know, the Grammy award shows, things like that, you know, starting to work in the movie soundtrack industry and then record dates for other artists. So that part was all great. But I'm the kind of person, it's fortunate and unfortunate. I mean, I like it about me, but I don't like it about me that I always have to be pushing, okay, what's next? So I've done this and that was great and wonderful. But now what do I have to do to push myself to the next level? I want to keep trying to do more things. And that's why I decided to do the album, because I wanted to really push, okay, what can I create? What can I make as an artist myself?
What was the first job you got that really made you feel like I made it?
I remember because my lip was trembling. It was the Academy of Country Music Award show. And I was performing with Martina McBride, who's always been one of my favorite vocalists. And I was literally so happy and so full and excited that I could not stop my lip from trembling. And all I could think was, oh my gosh, I'm on TV and I don't want anyone to see that my lip is trembling. But that one I remember, having that feeling like, okay, this is it. Because for me, I think of everything I do, TV is my favorite, because I love the live performance aspect. I love having a huge crowd there to feed off of. But then to also know that what you're doing is going to millions of people in the world, for me, that's like the biggest rush, to think that you can touch those that many people at once with something that you're doing.
Tell me what it's like to work with. I mean, you've worked with so many artists. I can't pick one, but I would love for you to pick one of the artists that you've worked with and tell us what it's like to be involved in one of these, you know, huge productions, these concert tours.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the person that I often go back to is Celine Dion. I worked with her for 4 solid years, as also doing like some record dates with her here and there. The reason that I always talk about her is I feel like she's really a model of, you know, what to do right in the entertainment industry. I mean, you see a lot of people maybe doing the wrong things, being in the tabloids for the wrong reasons. She, despite being so famous for so many years, still knows that family is the most important thing. When you talk to her, she would much rather talk to you about her kids than anything else. It's really true. Like, all the things that, you know, you hear about her are really true. She's super genuine, super wonderful, very goofy. You know, she makes it more of a family environment where everybody's included the same. You know, I mean, it's just people always ask, is she really that nice? And I can honestly say that she really is. And it's a good feeling to be able to say that. And in addition to her just being a good person, she's a great artist to watch as a musician, because every night the quality of what she's doing is so high. She could be making an album every night, every show that she does. And that's another thing that's rare. You hear artists that sound amazing. There's a lot of studio magic that we can do, right, in the studios, changing pitch, changing sounds. But she's the real deal. She really sounds like that. And it's inspiring.
All right, so what was it like to work with Kiss?
Kiss was actually a funny story. We were playing on one of the finales from American Idol, and they were performing with Adam Lambert. That was the year that he was one of the finalists. And I remember the story very well because I was actually pregnant with my son at the time. I was 5 months pregnant. And they do a lot of pyro on their shows. And so the fire marshal came to the rehearsal because they had to approve how much pyro they were going to be using. And it seemed like pretty tame, so they got the approval. But their tour manager told me, because he saw that I was pregnant, he said, just so you know, this is only about 10% of what they're going to do in the show. So to keep you safe, you know, we might need to move you. So we played on the song of theirs called Beth, which was more of a ballad with strings. We played, and then they were going to do something else where they were going to go up on a big stage. And I just hightailed it out of there. And as soon as everybody else saw it, they evacuated the stage as well. So everybody was kind of protecting me in my little pregnant belly. So.
And then everybody was safe. No one got hurt.
No one got hurt.
That's nice.
But it was a little dicier than what they thought it was going to be. So. Yeah, they like their big shows.
Now, right now, you know, you have been working on your album, and I can imagine that you have a lot of artistic freedom with that. Working with an orchestra that's doing a movie soundtrack, or working with an artist that has very specific expectations for what you're going to bring to the performance, contrast that with working on your own project, because I can imagine that, I mean, in one case, you don't have much freedom at all.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of a big reason I do still play in orchestras live as well, just as a part-time thing. But again, it's not your decision. You're not creatively involved. You do what the conductor says so that it sounds great together, and that's your job. And then, as you said, on movie soundtracks, you are doing exactly what the composer wants and for the film. That's the other thing that's really interesting about that world. It's not really just the music. It's what is the music doing to serve the picture and serve the story. So that's a whole different role.
When you're recording a movie soundtrack, do you get to see the film? Do you know what's going on?
Yeah. Yeah, we do get to see. It depends on where you're located as a violinist. Sometimes our backs are slightly to the screen. And obviously, you know, you're really focused on the music. But then they'll do a playback and then you can turn around and see. So I've definitely been able to see some scenes before. And, you know, you can't take pictures or release any information. I remember I played on the soundtrack for Finding Dory, for example. And I was very excited about that because my son's favorite movie was Finding Nemo. Wow, I'm playing in something my son's going to love. And it started very early days. I mean, that usually the film scoring comes the very last part of the movie. The movie's done, then they add the music. But Finding Dory, they kind of do it in pieces. So, like, we did some very early on in the movie where the animation wasn't even completely done. And then we did more later on. So you have to be careful not to release, you know, any pictures or anything like that. And there's a lot of disclosure forms that you fill out in the music industry. So all those roles, you're doing something that somebody else wants you to do, and it's, you know, that's your job there. So I think, you know, there's a group of us musicians that's fine, that's all they want to do, but then there's those of us that need to have that creative outlet. Okay, so that's great, but what am I going to do? You know, what is my voice? What do I want to do when I'm doing my own project? So that really fed me to make this album.
And where did the idea for mashing up movie music and the music of the masters come from?
Well, I had one specific idea first, which was Braveheart. And I went to a composer friend of mine named Chad Raymond in L.A. And I had a meeting with him and kind of talked him through my idea. I said, I'm hearing these melodies in my head where I hear a movie soundtrack, but then I hear this other melody that would be really cool together with it. And, you know, after shows like Glee that would mash up just two pop tunes, I thought that idea was kind of cool, that, wow, you're making something new in a way you haven't heard it before, but these tunes that are familiar. So I talked him through the idea. Thank goodness he saw my vision. We got working on Braveheart and put Jupiter from the Planets together with that, made a video for that. And that did well. And then just kind of one by one, I would hear melodies. We did one with Pirates of the Caribbean and Beethoven 9, for example. And that one he didn't want to do because he said, everybody does Pirates. We don't want to do another Pirates. I said, yeah, but nobody's done it with Beethoven 9. So that got him excited again. You know, we got together. We hashed that one out. I know a lot of the ideas I've had he thought were absolutely crazy. Putting together Stravinsky's Firebird with Jai Ho from Slumdog Millionaire sounds kind of weird. But it works in the end. I would just hear melodies in my head and we just kind of get to work on them.
It struck me that in a way you're bringing together that Lisa, who was the very serious student and the very serious classical musician, with Lisa, who has spent all of her career in pop music.
Right. And, you know, that's always been a big idea of mine, is to bring classical music to people who think maybe I don't like classical music. But I remember early on in my career, people would listen to me practice, even if I was just playing scales or something. And I think being a singer, I understand how to play the violin as a voice. And so people connect with it a little more. And they would say things like, you know, I didn't think I liked the violin, but I like what you're doing. And so that kind of ignited a spark in me that I could be a voice for maybe types of music that people think, well, I don't want to go to a symphony. I'm not sure what to do. I don't know when to clap. Seems a little too stuffy for me, so I'm going to stay away from it. But the concerts that I want to do will incorporate the audience. One of the pieces has a drum line, for example, as part of the piece. So I want to collaborate with local high schools and bring their drum lines into the auditorium, like down the aisles, so people are surrounded by that. You know, for the Bollywood piece, I want to have scarves where people in the audience are waving scarves and, you know, part of it. And so they don't feel like they're so separated from that music anymore. Well, so that's definitely been a big goal of mine.
Lisa Donlinger, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Very appreciated.
Lisa Donlinger, her album is Movies and the Masters. She's back in Iowa to perform at and act as a judge at the Miss Iowa pageant this week. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.